number 07-1363 et al. County of Rockland County, New York. Petitioner versus Federal Aviation Administration. Mr. Blumenthal for petitioners on NEPA issues. Mr. Lee Bissman for petitioners on Section 4F issues 49 U.S.C. 7506C. Dr. Richmond for petitioners on Clean Air Act issues 42 U.S.C. 750C. Ms. Sprague for respondent on NEPA issues, and Mr. McFadden for respondent on Section 4F and Clean Air Act issues.
You ever see counsel?
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Richard Blumenthal, and I am the first counsel. There are three of us to represent the City of Rockland et al. Petitioners in this case. We will be dividing the argument three ways, and Mr. Liebesman, who will follow me, will argue the 4F issues. Ms. Lichtman, who is the third counsel, will argue the Clean Air Act issues, air quality. Even with the very substantial deference that is often accorded administrative agencies, this case should be sent back to the FAA, should be remanded for a new environmental impact statement, or at least a supplemental one, because this process is rife with systemic errors, failures that go to the core integrity and reliability and accuracy of the findings and conclusions here, failures in fact-finding that the FAA knew and failed to correct, failures to follow its own rules that the FAA failed to ameliorate, and failures in the systemic process itself that go to the core of the NEPA process. And our argument here is that we're not fly-specking or nitpicking. We're not complaining about methodology. Our argument goes to the integrity and reliability of this process, which was fatally infected with error. And we believe that is true of the failure to do projections of noise impact, failure to correct errors in facts that went into the baseline judgment, failure to do noise compliance monitoring, failure to implement night ocean routing, and related failures to consider the growth-inducing effects of the project, congestion management, cumulative effects, and the failure to consider the impacts on minority populations as is required by environmental justice considerations. Among the probably four most glaring errors the court, we suggest, respectfully ought to consider, there is the failure to project or forecast noise levels. Now, the FAA says that they chose an appropriate time frame.
Well, no question they did project noise levels.
Well, that is a matter that we contend.
They did project noise levels. You may not like the methodology. You say you're not fly-specking, but you can't stand there with a straight face and say they did no projection on noise levels.
Well, the question is, what was the date of the forecast? Their own rules in FAA Order 1050.14.4G say that the implementation date is the key point from which the forecast should be made. Here, the implementation date, according to the FAA, was 2011. In fact, they now say it's 2012. They did no forecast, none, Your Honor, with all due respect, from 2011. Not 5 years, not 10 years. In fact, a
negative. So you are saying in a very long way, yes, they did some forecasts. They did them wrong. You are going to the methodology.
Well,
stand there and say they failed to do any forecasting. Counsel, we read these papers. We know that's not right.
And I would just say respectfully, Your Honor, before moving to the next point, they can define it as a forecast because they've said it is from 2006 to 2011. But normally, forecasts are from the date of implementation, and they did none from that date. The critical aspect of the night ocean routing issue concerns the fact that it is in the preferred or selected alternative. It is part of what the FAA committed to do. And by failing to do it, as they have failed to do, they have changed the nature of the process, project. Under the rules 40 CFR 1509, they must, in effect, do some kind of supplemental environmental
review. Whose rule is that?
I'm sorry?
You just cited something from the CF Code of Federal Regulations. Is that an FAA rule?
No, that's the rules of administrative procedure, Your Honor. And they have, under 40 CFR 15...
Is that Council on Environmental Quality, or is that an FAA rule?
We're talking about 40 CFR...
Is that a
1502.9.
Is that a Council on Environmental Quality rule, or is it an FAA rule?
I believe it is the Code of Federal Regulations.
Well, I know that.
Yeah.
Which applies to the FAA. It's an FAA rule. It applies...
Well, we've got different rules here. We've got rules from the Council on Environmental Quality being cited, and we've got the FAA's rules. And I think it's rather important which rule this is.
Well, this...
According to your brief at 30, rather, it's a CEQ.
So it's a CEQ rule. There's a case, one of the big NEPA cases that we had, dealing with the building of the Woodrow Wilson Bridge. And I don't know if you read that, but it's something versus Slater, City of Alexandria versus Slater. And there's a footnote in that case that points out that there's a substantial doubt whether the Council on Environmental Quality has any rulemaking authority. It's never been resolved. And so there's a question whether when you cite CEQ rules, those rules may be totally invalid. And it's an issue that's not even addressed in 133 pages of your brief.
I understand Your Honor's concern. But
or anybody else's, yeah. So Jimmy Carter issued an executive order that gave the CEQ the authority to issue regulations. And there's no congressional authorization for that, for them to have lawmaking authority. That's the problem.
Your Honor, night ocean routing is part of the record of decision at page 50. It is something that is not governed by the CEQ rules. It is part of what binds the FAA in this case. And the FAA itself said that if night ocean routing was not included, in effect, some kind of environmental review would have to be done. And the same principle applies, Your Honor, to the noise compliance monitoring issue, where, as part of the FEIS, the noise compliance monitoring commitment was made. That commitment is binding on the FAA. The FAA's own rules say, at paragraph 512 of the FAA order 1050, 14.4, any mitigation measure that was made a condition of the approval of the FEIS must be included in the record of decision. These are not discretionary, deferential issues. They are parts of the record where the FAA made commitments. They are bound by the FEIS. It's not an issue of methodology or of discretion or deference. They are in the record, Your Honor. We cite the record, for example, on the noise compliance monitoring, the FEIS appendix Q at 33. These are all in the record, Your Honor. They are commitments They are ROD issues and terms that are in that record. And finally, in conclusion, Your Honor, the failure to correct the baseline noise impacts, which had the effect of diminishing or eviscerating the increases in noise levels, again, Your Honor, under its own rules, 1051E14-4E, are required by the FAA's own rules, and it knew the data was mistaken. It knew that it was overestimating traffic operations at Newark by 14%, at JFK by 17%, at Philadelphia by 13%, and it failed to correct those errors in violation of Bensonville standards, which says that the FAA must use the best information available when it began its analysis, and then checking the assumptions of those models using new information as it became available. The FAA failed to do so here. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from Mr. Liebsman.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Morning, counsel.
The FAA's conclusion that the project would not result in a constructive use of any federal, state, or local 4F property in this five-state area was an error because the FAA took procedural shortcuts in violation of the clear direction of Congress in enacting 4F to give paramount protection to federal, state, and local parkland. This was done in two major areas. First, the FAA arbitrarily and selectively only studied a number of parks. They omitted 235 state and local parks from any assessment, which could be up to 50% or even greater of the total universe of parkland out there. Because indeed, we have identified parks and come up with a list just for petitioners. That doesn't include parks within the jurisdiction of non-petitioners. Secondly, they failed to provide an opportunity for notice and comment of a critical, supplemental, specific analysis of 12 individual federal facilities, federal parks, selectively and arbitrarily not providing an opportunity for comment. Petitioners did not know about this until the record of decision was issued. Section 4F is very clear. The plain language of 4F is that the DOT secretary may approve use of a national, state, or local park or recreation area of significance only if there are no prudent and feasible alternatives. Overton Park made it very clear that the existence of this statute indicates that protection of parkland was to be given paramount importance. The legislative history quoted in Overton Park says that the secretary is not to limit his consideration to information supplied by state and local officials, but is to even go beyond that information. There's an affirmative obligation. Indeed, the FAA's own regs are very specific. They create a presumption in 6.2A that expressly says any part of a publicly owned park, recreation area, refuge, or historic site is presumed to be significant unless there is a statement of insignificance relative to the whole park by the federal, state, or local official having jurisdiction thereof. Thus, the FAA, under its own regs, must first identify, and that's critical, screening the universe of potential 4F resources at the federal, state, and local level before determining if there's even a potential use of that significant resource out there, and then going to the third step of the analysis of whether they're prudent and feasible alternatives.
So I'm not sure I'm getting this. You're saying they didn't do the screening?
That's correct. They did not do proper screening. They omitted looking at up to 235 state and local parks that we have identified. We have 22 declarations from state and local officials that they were never contacted. And many of these parks were of a quiet nature that could have
triggered... Wait a minute, that they were never contacted is not relevant to this.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Why is it relevant, in your view, that the officials, the park officials, weren't contacted?
Because
if they've been screened out, if those parks have been screened out validly, there's no reason to contact them.
Quite simply because of, number one, the direction of Congress to protect and preserve these resources. In the FAA's own regs, there's a presumption in the regs that they must obtain the views of state and local officials. That's 6.2A, presumed to be significant. It's critical language. Unless there is a statement of insignificance relative to the whole park. So how can they make that determination unless they reach out, contact these officials, and get a determination? There is an affirmative duty and an obligation on the part of the FAA.
It didn't say anything about contacting the officials in the regulation you quoted. You just inserted that on the ground that that's the only sensible way to proceed.
It's in the regulation.
That they contact the official of every park in the affected region?
That's what their own regs say. And
so in other words, no screening can be done?
There is selective screening. What they
I forgot there was. You're telling me no screening can be done. They have to contact every park's official, correct?
No, I'm saying that to do screening, the first step in the screening is they have to contact officials. You cannot screen unless...
Okay, fine. But that's how they have to contact every park official initially.
Right.
And then they can screen out those that say no effect here or what?
They can, after that, apply their analysis to determine whether these parks are significant, whether there would be a use. But the first step of the analysis is how do they know the universe of parks out there? How can they do a valid screening unless they actually go out and contact those officials?
Now you got two things going.
Yeah.
They don't know the universe, and they haven't contacted the officials. So are both of those what you're saying?
Well, I'm saying is that in order to know the universe, they have to reach out and contact these officials.
I think it's the other way around. The universe of parks?
They have to know what the...
How could they contact the officials unless they already know the universe of parks?
What they can do, and they admit this, is they say in the EIS there are 64 counties and several hundred municipalities out there. So they had the capability, and indeed the regs impose a burden to actually go out there and contact these officials. They could easily find out who the official is in those 64 parks and say, what parks do you have within your jurisdiction? Let us know. Give us information about the potential significance of those parks. This was a massive effort over 9 years. And what they did in the record...
Massive effort wasn't done in a corner.
Excuse me?
This massive effort wasn't done in a corner. There were the usual notices, CFRs. They didn't hide and do this massive effort. If the local officials in the parks had concerns, they're not that hard to find.
Yeah, and they didn't, but they didn't do
it. It's a massive effort. You've admitted that. I'm not sure where you're coming from on this, counsel. If the officials had some problem, why don't they run in and tell them they've got a problem?
But because they had an obligation to actually go out and identify.
Yet they had an obligation. You're not answering my question. Why don't the local officials, if they got a problem, have some reason to act on their problem?
Because
don't tell me somebody else had an obligation. Answer that question.
Because we read the intent of their own regs is that the burden is on the FAA to reach out and identify.
Therefore,
these
if we want to protect our parks, we have to do nothing. Therefore, if we want to protect our parks, we have to do nothing. How does them having a burden compel local officials to have a problem not to raise their own problem? It doesn't say they can't come in and tell us, does it?
Well, but with all due respect, Your Honor, I think what we read the regs and the statute of 4F to say is that the FAA cannot, you know, say, well, if we give general notice, then the local officials have to come to us. We're saying they have to go to them and say, what parks do you have out there? That's what 4F is all about. That's what Overton Park seems to say. They say there's a burden to know what the total number of parks
in Overton Park.
Excuse me?
You had one park in Overton Park, and actually the officials there were objecting to the highway, weren't they?
Yeah, but this is a different factual scenario here.
Yes, it is.
This is a massive
scenario.
So here what
scenario.
They did was they said, well, there are certain areas that are not affected by noise, not implicated by this change at all, that are in the region.
There are certain areas that are. That's correct, but
that are not affected.
But there's certainly...
So they didn't contact anybody in those areas. You don't object to that, do you?
Well, to the best of our knowledge, they didn't contact some people that aren't affected, but this is a huge project, and the overflights are affecting a good number of jurisdictions. They admit 64 jurisdictions, counties. So the potential impact on the broad universe of parks out there is extreme. And why this is so critical is we have a couple of parks in particular, like Centennial Park in Connecticut, of which there was no contact at all to the state official. That was a 15,000-acre park of a quiet nature. And there was no communication
Here's what this is Section 4F, right? The responsible FAA official must consult all appropriate federal, state, and local officials having jurisdiction over the affected Section 4F resources when determining whether project-related noise impacts would substantially impair their resources. So if they've made a threshold determination, if the FAA has, that certain areas are not affected and the resources in there are not affected Section 4F resources, then they don't need to contact them, right?
That's
great.
The
only question at the threshold is whether they made a reasonably determined that some resources were not Section 4F affected resources.
And that's the essence of our case, that they did not go
now,
out.
Now, wait a minute. You're saying they didn't contact them. They don't have to contact them unless they meet this test of being in having affected resources. That comes first.
With all due respect, I look at it the other way, because the presumption says that they must first consult and identify. The word identify is in their own rule. Identify all potentially affected 4F resources. How can they first identify without at least reaching out and consulting with and getting information from park
officials?
That's
your question. That's a question you can raise with them, but the answer they give you is we did it by using our projected noise contours, right?
And we believe that that's not sufficient, because what they need to do, and why this is so critical, is because just identifying it is not sufficient. Like Centennial Park, there may be a need for a more detailed site-specific analysis. A park that is quiet in nature for the public is being hurt greatly by this project, and yet that information was not provided directly to the FAA at all. We have the affidavit from the state official in the state of Connecticut who did not in any way discuss the impact, the importance of Centennial Park. We have Rockefeller State Park, a park in which by state law is considered of quiet nature, where a more detailed analysis may be indicated. So without actually having that consultation, the FAA cannot know whether they should do that more detailed analysis.
Yeah, you're over time unless my colleagues have further questions. So
okay, thank you.
We'll hear from Ms. Lichtman.
Good morning, Chief Judge Sentell.
Good morning.
Judge Randolph and Judge Ginsburg. If it please the court, a simple procedural matter. We have indicated to the clerk that we would appreciate 2 minutes of rebuttal time for each topic, a total of six.
We, in this circuit, have never, ever preserved rebuttal time. I realize many courts of appeal do that. I grew up in the Fourth Circuit where they did. We never have. We decide often to give you back rebuttal time, but if you've talked into it, then we don't preserve it. Are you saving it this morning, Shane?
Yes, sir.
We are. Okay. I take it back. This morning we're preserving your rebuttal time.
Oh, but I was going to defer
That's
to the
first time I recall us ever preserving a rebuttal time.
We do ask for rebuttal time, and they check in, sir.
Okay.
In any event,
just have them talk into it. Have they talked into it this morning?
They have talked into it.
But we have not preserved the rebuttal time. I was right to begin with. No, I was right to begin with. We have not preserved your rebuttal time.
But I think we should reset Ms. Lichtman's clock.
Yes. Okay, we will reset your clock. If we want to give you back the time that we talked you into, then what I mean by not preserved rebuttal time, Shane, is we have not protected it. In the Fourth Circuit, for example, if the court takes them into that rebuttal time doesn't have to be restored. They keep it. We don't protect it here. If you talk into it, it's gone. However, we often give it back. We'll start your clock again instead of wasting your time talking about whether we preserve rebuttal time or not. When you come back and see us, remember that the court's not going to protect that time. But the orange light is going to come on and let you know that you're in it. But you can't do anything about it if we're still talking. We're going to use it up. We'll start her over again unless...
Well, Ms. Lichtman, it says PhD here. Are you a member of the Bar of the Court?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm both, to my great dishonor, the PhD part. First, I want to thank Chief Judge Sentell and Judge Ginsburg for resetting my clock. Having been here before, Judge Sentell, I was about to ask the court's permission to take that rebuttal time, but you have clarified the way this court is now working. To go to substantive matters, the record shows two major omissions from the FAA's air quality analysis, which are dispositive of petitioner's claims in this case. First, the FAA acknowledges in its own properly promulgated order, 1050.1E, as well as its guidance handbook, that in the absence of a conformity analysis, in order to be found to conform pursuant to 42 U.S.C. 7506, one of two procedures have to be followed. The first is to establish an exemption as de minimis, meaning not significant impact on air quality. In order to do that, there has to be two elements. One, there has to be a calculation of direct and indirect emissions from specific criteria pollutants that are listed in FAA's order 93.153B. And second, there has to be a comparison of the total of those direct and indirect emissions of criteria pollutants to the thresholds, the de minimis thresholds, set forth in 93.153B.
Ms. Lichtman, I truly searched your brief on this point in the hope of finding somewhere the reason that you're advancing this concern, and I frankly can't find it. This is a program that reduces jet fuel consumption and jet fuel emissions, and you want to have a calculation of the baseline from which it's reduced, and I'm not sure why.
Your Honor, if the fuel burn analysis, which is, I believe, the basis of your assumption that fuel burn will be reduced and therefore emissions will be reduced.
Well, do you doubt that fuel burning will be reduced?
I can't say, but I do defer to the FAA on the fuel burn issue because they are the experts on aircraft engines.
194 metric tons or something per day.
Pardon me?
194 metric tons per day reduction, correct?
There is no link in the fuel burn analysis between fuel burn and emissions.
Well, I thought you repudiated in your reply brief any claim that you doubted there was a link between fuel burning and the emissions from fuel burning.
No, we cannot say, first of all.
Because the government attributed that to you, I thought, and you said, no, that would be ridiculous.
That there is no link in the fuel burn analysis because there is no mention of emissions. Sorry to say, there's no calculation of emissions, let alone criteria emissions, at all in that fuel burn analysis.
Are you doubting that emissions come from burning fuel?
Partially, Your Honor. Not completely.
You're partially doubting it?
No, sir. They partially come from burning fuel, but okay. They also come from other sources, which the EPA's rule requires be included.
Other sources that are implicated in this change that the FAA is working?
Yes, Your Honor.
What are they?
Well, to begin with, the FAA repudiates it, but we believe that in any conformity, we don't believe, we know, that in any conformity analysis, there has to be a calculation of the emissions from ground support equipment, gate, preconditioned air. There are all sorts of sources on
that group, APUs, GAVs, GS, right? Those three.
Correct.
And the administration, the FAA, says that's not being changed. If we have a plane landing, we have the same amount of supporting vehicles and so on at the runway as regardless of the change in the flight pattern.
That does not exempt, under the EPA's properly promulgated rule, the responsibility.
Well, tell me some way in which following that rule, in which failing to follow that rule would not be utterly harmless because we're talking about a reduction in fuel burning.
Because fuel burn is not directly related
to emissions. Okay, so tell me some way in which this would be a problem. You're saying the gate vehicles would consume more fuel than the planes conserve?
Depending on taxi times, depending on, Your Honor.
Well, are taxi times being changed by this?
We don't know. We
don't know that a lot of things, but they're not relevant to this proceeding. So why is this relevant to the – why is there reason to worry that taxi times are being changed?
Your Honor, if I may, there are several components to emissions other than fuel burn and that are also varying the emissions with respect to certain types of fuel burn.
But for instance, these rules change any of those variables?
No, it may change some variables, Your Honor, because aircraft burn fuel – at different rates, at different speeds.
We're out of the fuel burn, though. As to these other factors besides fuel burn, is there anything that this rule is changing in a detrimental fashion?
We can't know because there was never any calculation of emissions from anything in this project.
Well, we have to have some reason to think that it might have been a problem or the error seems harmless.
The EPA has said that if you don't do these procedures, it's harmful.
No, they've said you must do them. Therefore, it's an error if you don't do them. The question is, why isn't it a harmless error?
This is
a functional question, not a formal matter. I want a common sense reason to think that something may be amiss as a result of their skipping this rule.
And I am attempting to give you that. I personally am not a scientist, but I do know that the components, the required components of an air quality emission study at an airport include ground support equipment. A mere conclusion by the FAA that ground support equipment will not change emissions therefrom without the calculation
of emissions. Well, give me an example of a piece of ground support equipment that might change.
Tow trucks.
Tow trucks might be used and burn more fuel under this rule than otherwise.
No, but there could be more tow trucks. There could be more tow trucks used if, for instance, these aircraft, more are allowed to come in or more at the same time. Some have to wait in the penalty box, which is where they put the aircraft off. Then they're towed in later because the airlines won't leave the fuel, the engines running for indefinite periods of time. So we may have more tow trucks emitting more. We may have more preconditioned air or less or fewer preconditioned air gates, which have more emissions impact. We don't know because we don't know the emissions impact because they were never, ever calculated. And specifically, Your Honor, the criteria pollutants. Aircraft at different modes of operation emit different criteria pollutants in greater numbers.
And if they're going more slowly?
Pardon me?
What if they're going more slowly?
If they're going more slowly, there are certain criteria pollutants, and I believe our consultant commented in the record that NOx and one other criteria pollutant are emitted at higher rates with slower engines. And that could be, although I am not a scientist in that regard.
First of all, you have a PhD. What's it in?
Urban and regional planning.
Oh, okay.
Economics. Okay.
You are now into your rebuttal time, but finish your sentence.
Okay.
Or use your rebuttal time as you like.
I understand. So there was never any calculation of emissions. Without such a calculation, we cannot reach a rational conclusion that there will be a reduction sufficient to become either exempt or presumed to conform. No emissions calculation and certainly none of criteria pollutants. So the FAA has acknowledged repeatedly that it has to do this. It's not that they didn't know it or they weren't informed. They knew they had to make these calculations by their own order. They didn't do it. So what we have here is no air quality analysis of any kind. And
what's the consequence if they find that it would exceed the state implementation plan, that the emissions
the project cannot be implemented,
even though it's a federal project?
Because it's a federal project, no federal action may take place that
causes a state to be in excess of its implementation plan limits.
That is correct. That causes it to exceed, that impacts it adversely. There are four elements in 42 U.S.C. 7506 that a federal project cannot do and still be implemented. So the impact here is, without an emissions calculation, we don't know if it violated any of those and is, in fact, in violation of the state implementation plan.
Thank you, Mr. Lincoln.
Thank you, counsel.
I've got 6 minutes. 6 seconds.
Oh, you want to go on?
No, I have 3 seconds. Okay, well,
thank you.
We'll see about giving you back more later for rebuttal. We're committing to nothing.
Okay.
Ms. Sprague.
May it please the court, I'm Mary Gay Sprague with the United States Department of Justice, representing the Federal Aviation Administration. I'm going to address the NEPA issues this morning. With me are Mr. Lane McFadden, who will address the 4F and Clean Air Act issues, Ellen Durkee, and Mr. Steve Kelly, who is the program manager for the New York, New Jersey, Philadelphia Airspace Redesign Project. It's important to consider petitioners' complaints in the context of this airspace redesign project and the FAA's extraordinary environmental analysis. The purpose of this project is to increase the efficiency and reliability of the airspace structure and air traffic control system, thereby accommodating growth while enhancing safety and reducing delays in air travel. This project is just one part of the national airspace redesign that FAA launched in 1998. The key to this airspace redesign is improved technology. The basic structure of the departure and arrival paths for each of the major airports in the region was created in the 1960s based on 1960s air traffic control technology and the capabilities of 1960s aircraft. This project rebuilds this structure using 21st century technology, including the global positioning system. Many of us now rely on GPS devices in our cars, but their air traffic control system can't effectively utilize this satellite navigation technology without realigning the old departure and arrival paths. This regional airspace redesign is a critical foundation for the next generation air transportation system that FAA and the aviation industry are working to achieve by 2025. Given that the region's airports handle 16% of the national air traffic, this project is critical to FAA's national airspace redesign. Inefficiencies in New York and Philadelphia ripple through the entire system. FAA has already completed airspace redesign in some other areas of the country, including Baltimore, Washington. But this is the most complicated redesign FAA has undertaken, given the number, closeness, and level of traffic.
You may wish to move on into the issues of the case, counsel. You may wish to move on into the issues of the case, counsel.
That's fine, Your Honor.
We have had hundreds of pages of record and briefs to familiarize us with the background.
A central complaint goes to the traffic forecasting that FAA did. It's important to know that there was a need for this project when the national plan was launched in 1998. This was not a project that was premised on projecting that there might be a need sometime in the future. There was a current need when this program was launched. Petitioners make in their briefs and today three complaints about FAA's traffic forecast. The first is they're too high. The second is they're too low. And the third is there should have been three instead of two of them. None of these complaints is substantial enough to overcome the high degree of deference this court affords to FAA's traffic forecast. These forecasts were developed not just for the environmental analysis, but as the basis for the operations modeling. In 2001, FAA took the actual traffic data from 2000. It analyzed trends in the economy generally and in the aviation industry specifically, and it created a model world of air traffic for 2006, which was the year that at that time FAA anticipated implementing the airspace redesign. This includes projecting passenger demand for specific origins and destinations, projecting how airlines respond to that demand by providing flights with specific routes, aircraft, and scheduling. FAA then projected these trends farther into the future and created a second model world of air traffic for 2011, which was 5 years after FAA anticipated implementing airspace redesign. The forecasting methodology is set forth in the FEIS Appendix B1 in the Joint Appendix. The first complaint is that in 2006, it turned out that when FAA took a look at the 2005 actual traffic, the projections, in fact, were higher than the actual traffic was showing. This was because there were a number of events had occurred in the industry that had not been anticipated in the projecting data. But at that point in time, FAA did exactly what this court said it should do in Town of Bensonville and other cases, which is that it analyzed the changes to see if anything had occurred that would cause it to reevaluate its operations or its environmental impacts analysis. And based on that detailed analysis, FAA concluded that its projections in their direction and magnitude were sufficient to support the modeling and the analysis, and nothing more was required. Petitioners have also made the argument that the projections were too low and that FAA did not account for the what they called induced demand in air travel that would follow this airspace redesign. I think there's been some confusion about how FAA does its forecasting and what this means. Everyone in this case agrees that there will be natural growth in air traffic through the foreseeable future. The issue is, in your forecasting, that natural growth has to be taken into account for both the no-action alternative and the project. The question is whether any given project would cause that natural rate of growth to be changed in some way. It's FAA's judgment, based on its experience that with airline scheduling behavior, that this kind of a project, an airspace redesign project, is not the kind of project that causes a material deviation in the natural rate of growth at an airport. And that conclusion has been accepted by this court, and it has in City of Olmsted Falls with respect to a terminal project, slightly different project, but also the Ninth Circuit has directly addressed this issue in the cases relating to change in arrival paths at LA Airport and Seattle-Tacoma Airport. There are projects, of course, which can cause a deviation from the natural rate of growth. If a city wanted to make, if Oklahoma City decided it wanted to try to take some of Dallas-Fort Worth's hub traffic and undertook a significant airport expansion to try to take some of that traffic, yes, in that environmental analysis process, you would have to increase your projections of forecasted traffic over the natural rate of growth because a significant event that could cause a material change has occurred. But this is simply not that kind of a case.
But you said that the induced demand is not material. Do you have in the record or in the experience of the agency data confirming that the induced demand is a slight phenomenon?
Your Honor, it is through its that's addressed in part in the forecasting work, and it's also can be implied from documents in which FAA does address induced demand and looks at the specific demand.
And is there any empirical evidence that the effect is not material?
That's based on empirical evidence, Your Honor. It's based on FAA's experience with passenger response to projects, including projects that reduce delay, and airline response to those projects. This is a matter...
It implies that passengers are indifferent to delay. If its reduction doesn't detract them.
Your Honor, it...
At least over the relevant range.
Pardon me?
At least over the relevant range of reduction.
That's...
Yes.
The studies have not shown that they are totally indifferent. It's just there's not a material difference.
Okay, that's what I wanted to bring out. So you've got studies that show there is a difference, but it's not sufficient to warrant...
Your Honor, that's correct.
At least over that range of variation.
Yeah. Pardon me, Your Honor?
At least over that range of variation.
Yeah.
That's correct. It's very difficult to unbundle when you look at traffic, why the traffic is changing in the way it is. There are many different factors at play. And when you have a factor that is not expected to have a material difference, it's just it's difficult to tease out. And so FAA does not require and does not, in fact, do that with projects of this nature. The third complaint the petitioners have made is that FAA should have undertaken a third year of forecasting analysis, that it should have created a third world of air travel in 2016 or sometime into the future. First of all, we don't believe that that was required by the FAA's own orders, which say that you have to choose appropriate timeframes in light of the project. Here, this project began to be implemented in 2007. Now we know that the implementation won't be completed by 2012. But for FAA to have devised a model world for 2016, given the complexity, the number of airports in this region, and the specificity with which they have to project that air travel, it simply would not have been reliable enough to give useful information. And petitioners have not pointed to any trend that they see that might occur after 2011, when the FAA's second forecast was done, that could materially change FAA's analysis of whether this airspace redesign is going to make the air structure better or worse, or whether there would be any material noise impacts. So neither of these complaints about the forecasting is, in fact, a systemic error, as they have pointed out. With respect to noise, which is the second group of complaints that they have, the fact of the matter is that this project will actually reduce noise for thousands, hundreds of thousands of people throughout the study area.
Well, they're not complaining about that. They're complaining about the park situation in particular. So could you focus on that?
Yep. Right. Throughout their briefing, I think they are making noise complaints apart
from... Well, move to what the court asked you about. Your time's getting short.
The parks.
Parks.
Would you...
Judge Ginsburg asked you about the parks.
That's what they've put on the table today, parks. You want to refer that to your co-counsel?
Mr. McFadden, would you like him to address that now, Your Honor?
Well, we'll do it in your order.
I have one question before you sit down. We have an amicus brief from Senator Dodd and Senator Specter here. Did the Department of Justice consent to the filing of that brief?
Yes, Your Honor.
You know, there was a time when the Department of Justice refused to allow members of Congress to file amicus briefs on the basis that it was a violation of separation of powers. Mm. And we get an amicus brief with Senator Specter talking about a hearing that was held, that he held a year ago, putting material before us is not part of the administrative record.
Your Honor, I think we consented before we saw it. I think we consented in advance.
Mm. Well, you ought to go back to the archives because that was never the practice in the past to allow this kind of an amicus brief. I mean, if the congressman was directly affected, that's one thing. But what we're talking about is a brief where we have two senators telling us what was in their mind when particular legislation they voted for or sponsored got before the floor. And that's close to creates problems in the separation of powers. They want to talk to the courts, and then they do it through legislation, not by filing briefs. Yeah.
I wanted to address briefly the night ocean routing issue that was raised very briefly there. This is a part of the design that is not anticipated to be implemented until stage 4, which is in 2012. And there has been no decision made about the fact that that will not be implemented. The problem with this procedure, it's a noise mitigation procedure for Newark Runway 22 departures for the benefit of a number of communities in Union County, south of Elizabeth and west of Elizabeth, New Jersey. And the planes now come south out of Newark and turn to the west if they're going to the west. The night ocean routing would bring them farther south, send them out over the ocean so they can climb, then they turn around and come back to the west. This is not an efficient procedure. It is strictly a noise mitigation procedure. FAA rejected it as an alternative because it would be crossing the flight paths of JFK. They said on a limited basis after 10:30 at night, we will do it then. It turns out now there may be too much JFK traffic to actually implement the procedure. If they can't implement the procedure, there will be a supplemental environmental review at that point, and there's nothing we respectfully submit for this court to address at this point. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. Tell us about the parks, Counsel.
We may please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. Let's talk about the parks.
How many parks did the petitioners identify as impacted by this project during the consideration of it?
I don't have that number, Your Honor, but I can tell you that every park that was specifically identified to the FAA over the several years of consultation was looked at and was added either in Appendix F or Appendix J to the FAIS, and noises were calculated for those properties, or they were given special consideration because some of them required it. That was one of the ways in which FAA identified any property that might potentially be affected by Section 4F was by soliciting public comment.
Was there anything other than the City of Rockland's comment? It's on JA 1899 or whatever. Is that the only objection?
From the petitioners, I believe so. And I can't say that with certainty, but that's the only one I'm aware of.
That just mentions two parks.
That's right, Your Honor. And it says, generally, we remind the agency of its 4F obligations.
I'm complaining about methodology, not the park by park.
That's correct, Your Honor. No party, petitioner or otherwise, ever submitted the comment making the arguments that petitioners have put forward today, that the agency was required to contact every local official, or no petitioner or no party commented that the FAA's methodology was overlooking potential properties.
In the FEIS, the agency said it would take a further look at noise levels in certain parks. I believe there were eight.
Yes, sir.
And the results of that further look came in after the close of the public comment period and were appended to the record of decision, I think, as Appendix C, perhaps. Anyway, so there's an objection here that the petitioners and others didn't get an opportunity to comment on those further results. What's your answer to that?
It's twofold, Your Honor. One is that there is no separate public comment requirement in Section 4F or the FAA's order. The FAA, of course, is required to consult with officials, but it was not required to publish that by statute or regulation. The second answer goes to what potential harms might be, which is that these conclusions confirmed what FAA had already suspected, which was that there wouldn't be any constructive use of these properties. And petitioners now say, well, we would have raised quite a few arguments, but they've yet to identify any flaw in the FAA's analysis in that record of decision that suggests that there would have been a substantive comment made that might have changed the decision.
Well, in the FEIS, I could not find any firm conclusion that those parks would not be adversely affected.
That's true, Your Honor. For those
So I don't know how you can treat the supplemental information as merely confirmatory.
Well, what the FAA considered would be the result to these properties is not articulated in the FAIS, as Your Honor points out, precisely because they couldn't reach that conclusion without.
All right, so the FAIS is inconclusive, says we need more information. The more information comes in, but too late for public comment.
Yes.
And your answer to that is, well, public comment isn't required under what, 4F?
That's right.
Okay, the CEQ regulations say agencies shall make diligent efforts to involve the public in preparing and implementing their NEPA procedures.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you think you made diligent efforts, or is that not relevant here?
No, we believe the efforts here made with respect to 4F were more than diligent. I mean, there were several.
Even though they didn't include comment on this material.
That's right, because the specific parts in the FAIS that said these are inconclusive and will be researched further were identified and discussed and disclosed both in the draft and the final EIS. And so it wasn't as if none of this issue was ever raised until the record of decision. It was, in fact, an ongoing process and one that involved consultation with other federal agencies, especially the National Park Service.
Yeah, I understand. It's just that the public wasn't in a position to comment.
For many of them, no, although certainly
you reached no firm conclusion in the FEIS. You reached it finally on the basis of the supplemental information, which was not sort of tested, if you will, by objections.
That's true.
It wasn't cross-examined by the petitioners.
Well, yes, to the extent that they now say that they would have tested it, we've yet to this day to find out what that test would be.
Rockland County sent you a letter, and you all said we're not going to deal with it any further, right? This was,
again, because they simply asked us to revisit the issue without identifying what an additional methodology might have been or facts about those parts.
Well, you didn't. That's not what your response is. Your response didn't say that your objections are too limited or ill-founded. It said we've dealt with this and we're not going to deal with it again. Right? This was just before the ROD came out.
Yes, Your Honor. And nevertheless, we believe that process, given the extensive amount of information and public disclosure on the front end, is consistent with the CEQ regulations.
Of diligent efforts, I mean.
Sorry, Your Honor?
The CEQ regulation requiring diligent.
Requiring diligent.
May or may not be binding.
That's right. And we assume for purpose of argument that they bind us, although we take under advisement Judge Randolph's criticisms of that. And that was generally the approach of the agency to the parks, that it first studied the universe of noise. I mean, the Petitioners have never challenged, for example, the boundaries of the study area, which enclose what all the potentially environmentally affected areas of the country might be. And then instead they present a series of local parks, many of which are in Connecticut. And if you look at the list of 235 properties that they produced, they used the publicly available noise information that FAA put on a website so that all members of the public could see exactly how they would be affected by the project. And they went through what they thought was a similar analysis to what FAA did to identify the noise of those parks, and those parks turn out for the parks that have the most significant increase of those that they identify to be somewhere in the neighborhood of 31.8 to 40.7 DNL. And for basis of comparison, you can look at the chart at JA 1177. That's on the low end. That's a soft whisper from 5 feet away. And at the loudest end, it's a distant bird call. I mean, these are not the types of properties that will be sufficiently impaired so as to rise to a level of taking that property. And that's the requirement in the Department of Transportation regulations and in the FAA's order that constitutes a constructive use. And there's simply no property in the study area that experienced the kind of noise that would constitute a taking. And when the FAA first approached this project...
Is that the definition of what is a constructive use equals a taking? Is that what you're...
That's in the FAA's order, Your Honor. And it says that for constructive use based on noise impacts, the noise must be so great as to constitute a taking of that property or part of that property. And that was true when the FAA looked at the study area and began to consider its universe of noise. It identified first the universe of noise. It looked at all the significantly impacted census blocks, populated and unpopulated, and looked at those and identified all the public properties in there. And none of the properties they now present were in any of those significantly impacted noise areas. And in fact, because there were no significant noise impacts and there were also no slight to moderate noise impacts anywhere in the state of Connecticut or the state of Delaware, those properties were not considered further. The FAA reasonably concluded that the worst impacted public properties were not constructively used under Section 4F. Therefore, all the other properties that were impacted less severely also would not have constituted a constructive use. And that basic premise has never been challenged. I'd move quickly, if I can, to the Clean Air Act. As the record of decision makes clear, the FAA has two valid and legally independent bases for its decision. One is its reliance on 40 CFR 93.153C1, which is EPA's exemption for any de minimis activity. And the other grounds on which you might uphold the decision is the FAA's reliance on its presumed to conform list, which Category 14 describes the exact type of activities that are taking place under this project, air traffic control procedures that are designed to reduce delay or improve fuel efficiency. And Your Honor's asked about what the effect of the challenges, if you will, to Appendix R of the FEIS, the fuel burn report, could be, and I'm not certain what that is. The fact of the matter is that as a comparative matter, this project will cause less fuel to be burned than that of the no-action alternative, which is the appropriate comparison under
NEPA. What about tow trucks?
Well, Your Honor, I would have to speculate about tow trucks only to the extent that, as is demonstrated in the brief, taxi times actually will be reduced. Reducing delays on the ground means you need those tow trucks less because you have fewer planes in the penalty box so long that you have them turn off their engines and tow them into the gate. But as a record matter, Appendix R doesn't consider tow trucks and other ground vehicles because it forecasts growth based on the natural rate of growth that is anticipated and uses that forecast number as the basis for all the 2011 fuel burn emissions. So the number of forecasted growth in flights and number of operations accounts for that number of ground vehicles that are used to support those flights and operations.
Overall, there'll be, if I understand this correctly, a decrease in the amount of fuel burned.
Yes, Your Honor.
But that doesn't necessarily translate into de minimis, does it? I mean, for example, if there be a 100% increase in fuel burn at Teterboro and a reduction at the Philadelphia airport, then why is it that you can characterize the overall effect as de minimis when if New Jersey is out of conformity, and I think it is, this will make things worse in New Jersey, even though it may make things better in Philadelphia?
Well, in that circumstance, Your Honor, that might...
They haven't argued this. This is...
No, they haven't. Right. But it's a fair question, hypothetically.
It shows up in the reply brief.
Does it?
Teterboro-Morristown.
Yes.
Right? Which is too late, I grant you.
But. I agree. But to take the question for sake of argument, that might merit a closer look at the particular attainment region, so to look at a particular airport. But FAA thought that considering this project as a whole requires modeling the interrelation between arrivals at one airport and departures at another simultaneously, which is why in the discussion in the briefs about whether EDMS was the appropriate model, the FAA had to take the appropriate information from that database, but that's just for one airport, and the only way to model this to know what's going to happen is to account for changes in the sky, as well as changes in arrival and departure paths and what might be happening on the runway. And only looking at that holistic picture of those interrelated and crossing flight paths do you get a sense of what the actual results would be for the forecast here, and so that's why they modeled it the way that they did. I think had the agency had that kind of information, some indication that flights would double at one airport, certainly that would be the case. But ultimately, the conclusion of the agency was that at every airport, inefficiencies would decrease. And so there was no risk that there was some increase that was being overlooked or was being poorly considered, even at Teterboro.
What do you mean at every airport? If I thought we just started on the premise that Teterboro would, in fact, have an increase.
We did, Your Honor, and then I left that premise, which was adopted for sake of argument, and I wanted to explain that as a result of this project, that's not actually the case, that in fact these delays, the delay benefits that are described in the fuel burn analysis and in the FEIS will adhere to each of the airports in the study area, in the major airports.
Well, what do we do with the chart and the record that shows the opposite? There's a chart showing that fuel consumption, I believe it's fuel consumption, at Teterboro and Morristown will increase somewhat, not greatly, but somewhat, as a percentage.
Well, that, Your Honor, I'll have to look at it.
Okay.
I can see I haven't looked at it in a while.
I'll take another look. Well, it's not that easy. Wait a second. Dr. Lichtman said that aircraft flying at a lower speed may have a higher rate of emissions, I guess that means per quantity of fuel, for certain criteria pollutants, possibly including NOx and another one. Is that in the record, and have you dealt with it?
It wasn't specifically addressed in the record, Your Honor, because the assumption made in Appendix R is that the fuel signature, by which I mean what you get as a pollutant, changes as you burn fuel at various rates. Unquestionably, the quantity of fuel is strongly correlated to the amount of emissions overall. And so at the point where the amount of fuel being burned was decreased, though the actual ratio of those pollutants one to another might have changed somewhere along those different speeds, you're still getting less of them as a result. And that was the result that the FAA was looking to see.
So for all criteria pollutants, there will be a reduction not only of fuel burn, but there'll be a reduction of emissions.
That's correct, Your Honor. Because while you take an aircraft engine at two different speeds, you will have a different emission signature as a result, where you might have more NOx from the faster plane and less from the slower, or perhaps it's reversing. I, like Dr. Lichtman, also am not a scientist, but you will nevertheless, if you burn less fuel over time, that will result will be less emissions overall.
Well, their point, though, is that if you burn it at a slower rate, you're just saying the decrease will not be as great?
Well,
decrease in emissions?
No, I'm saying those are two different issues. If you burn at a slower rate, you will get more NOx and less, say, VOC or some other pollutant, whereas the ratio that you get...
But the more NOx is still less than you would get if you were burning more fuel?
That's the final answer, yes.
Okay. Now, look, if you look at 1742, the table at 1742... You'll see the TEBMMU, that's Teterboro and Morristown, have negative benefits.
Yes,
in the right,
you're right,
column.
Yeah.
Okay.
You're right.
If you look at 1743, it says at those two airport flights actually see a small penalty. Okay. So it's not correct that every airport will experience an improvement.
You're right. There is a penalty at those two.
So you're resting on the fact that this was raised in the reply brief and it's too late.
I am largely, that it was not commented on in response to the FEIS by anyone who identified The questions that Your Honors are suggesting now weren't raised to the FAA. No one said that you should study this differently. And at that
point, so they're not only not raised in the opening brief, they're not raised before the agency?
Not in the form Your Honor is addressing. Okay. There were several complaints of sort of more general matter that we want to see more consistency with the conformity requirements. Yeah.
Thank you, counsel.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
We'll give Mr. Blumenthal back 2 minutes for rebuttal if he wants it.
Your Honor, if with the court's permission, I'm going to yield to Mr. Liebsman.
We'll give Mr. Liebsman 2 minutes if he wants it.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to focus specifically on the park issue, and specifically Rockland County, the chair of the county legislature, sent a comment letter in saying, you need to address the impact on our county parks. And the FAA came back and said, we've already taken care of that. Then the FAA counsel says, well, there was a supplemental analysis and it was a logical outgrowth, and therefore we made reasonable efforts in not going ahead and making that available for public comment. Why that was such a critical omission and why it's distinguishable from the BIA case that they cite is that it had a totally brand new analysis of federal parks. See, the FAA makes it clear that they can go beyond DNL in Part 150 to do a specific analysis. So what they did in the supplemental analysis is they gathered data on the ground at Appalachian Trail and all the other parks and put this new information out. And they brought without getting an opportunity to comment for the public. That's a critical, critical omission. If, in fact, that had been put out, I can rest assured that my clients, all the other petitioners, would have said, you're drawing an arbitrary distinction. You've gone out and studied these federal parks, gathered this data, looking to determine whether a more site-specific on-the-ground analysis beyond just Part 150 is required. That would have been presented. We said, hold up, put the brakes on it. When we submitted comments, we knew the FAA was going to be doing the supplemental analysis. Don't rush the judgment. 4F says you must be very careful and sensitive. And what did they do? They simply went out and rushed the judgment. We raised the issue. If you look at what other problems there were in the record, you know, with respect to Rockefeller State Park, we said that the analysis did not have adequate baseline information on a critical park. By state law, it's supposed to be pristine. This is information that we were deprived of presenting.
In the Rockland County Parks case, Appalachian Trail and so on, what evidence is there of the DNL in the FEIS for that park? Are we talking something under 40?
No, admittedly, the DNL evidence was low. I will admit that. But the whole point is process, Your Honor. Certainly, the DNL levels.
Process is good, but sometimes an error of process is harmless. We need to have reason to think it's not.
It can, but see, the fact that there were omissions, and studies were not done not only of additional parks, but other potential resources out there. We've identified a number that are greater than 3.0 DNL. Could have been,
That's the delta. But,
right.
But what's the going in number?
Well, the numbers, admittedly, the numbers weren't high, but the point being is that even if there was a lower number, the opportunity to consult and say, in a particular park resource, because of the sensitivities, the nature, the law involved, maybe a lower number doesn't take into account the potential that would have a significant impairment on the use of that park. So the FAA keeps falling back on these numbers. What we're saying is it's a process that we were deprived an opportunity to comment on where that information should have been presented. I come back to Overton Park. The language of the Supreme Court, the presumption in their own regs, presumed to be significant unless proven otherwise. They are arguing that we have the presumption to overcome. The FAA has the presumption, and they didn't meet their burden. This critical supplemental analysis is so important in this process, and it's a gap. It's an omission in the record that was not addressed. And it's pervasive. It's not just Rockland.
The FEIS, the agency refers to 8 parks as to which it's deferring monitoring. But in your letter, and I think in your brief, you refer to 12 parks. Why the difference?
Well, the 12 parks, the supplemental analysis, as I recall, identified 12 parks. They screened out some parks to say that quiet is not a particular attribute of that park. And then they went and analyzed a number of parks where there's a greater than 3.0 DNL. The total that they considered, as I recall, in that supplemental analysis is 12 parks. They were mostly federal parks. They dealt with the Park Service. They didn't reach out and do an analysis with respect to the state parks.
Thank you.
And so the
Thank
only...
Thank you, Counselor. Your time is completed. We'll give Ms. Lichtman 2 minutes for rebuttal if you'd like. After this, we'll take a recess. Yeah.
Thank you for your indulgence, Your Honors. 3 points. One, we discussed, Judge Ginsburg and I discussed increased ground support equipment. Please note that this study, the fuel burn analysis, and the rest of the record does not address the accommodations on the ground for this decreased delay. When you decrease delay, you have more aircraft arriving and departing. But there is nothing in the
record. I think they deny that.
Pardon me?
I think they deny that. I think they said this is not about increasing throughput.
Right.
This is not about...
About increasing throughput.
I understand, but what I'm saying is
so we're talking about the number of flight the number of flights projected here is a constant, not changed by the diminished delay.
Correct. Here's the difference. They may arrive and depart closer together because of decreased delay. Maybe exactly the same number.
Okay.
But they may come and go faster. Mm-hmm. They will come and go faster with decreased delay, which means they may be on the ground together, which means the analysis that I gave Judge Ginsburg earlier is salient, because if they're there, they have to hold unless the airport has increased gates to accommodate them.
You know, nothing as I recall, there was some reason, I think it's a JA-37, to doubt whether this analysis applies to ground vehicles as opposed to air traffic planning. You remember that argument? It deals with 4C of a regulation?
The study itself, the record does not. However, the air quality analysis mandates that the FAA take into consideration possible changes, indirect emissions, not just necessarily direct ones, but indirect ones that may be caused at a later date and that are not directly caused by the project.
This is JA-37, 2.11 of, this is, I think, the presumed to conform regulation. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Says, certain federal actions are exempt from the requirement of the general conformity rule because they result in no emissions or emissions that are clearly below the rule's applicability emission threshold levels. These include, number 10, air traffic control activities, and adopting approach, departure, and en route procedures for air operations.
Yes, Your Honor.
So why doesn't that moot this point?
Because the EPA informed the FAA that because air traffic control procedures are not on the list of exempt actions contained in EPA's rule 93.153C2, they could not consider the project exempt pursuant to this list, this what we call the express exemption. They then had to fall back to exempt as de minimis, which is related but similar but not the same, which comes under a different section, 93.153C1, and requires the two factors that I discussed. One, a computation of total direct and indirect.
I recall that.
Comparison.
So in 211, where it says... result in no emissions or emissions that are clearly below the rule's applicability. That's not the de minimis?
No, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
That's
C2. Thank you, Counselor. Your time is up again.
Thank you, Your Honors.
The case is submitted. We will take a brief recess before we take up the next matter.
Stand, please. This honorable court will now take a brief recess.